Okay, we're going to continue with the book of Zechariah. This is the 10th part of Prophets of the Restoration. We're going to be looking at Zechariah 5. If you remember, Zechariah 3 and 4 were promises that were made to the to the people of Israel regarding the building of the temple. And they were promises that respected first the ministry under Joshua, the priesthood, and then the civil magistrate under Zerubbabel. And we ended last time talking about the two sons of oil, the two anointed ones, the two witnesses, and the place that they play in this prophecy and the typologies. Now in chapter 5, there's a very different turn from the earlier two visions. The fact is that chapter 5 is comprised of two separate visions, but they're not unrelated. These are visions which, as we see, are going to take a very radically different turn from all of the previous prophecies. Now, we went from sort of a general view of what was coming with regard to the church to a more specific view. And then the place of the ministry and the magistry in that providence respecting the church and people of God. As I've said a number of times, the immediate referent is the rebuilding of that second temple. And so we're going to continue to see language that respects the temple. It has reference to the temple. But the building of that second temple itself is typical of the coming of the gospel era, of Christ, and then of his church. And when we talk about the gospel era, we've got to divide that era into the early reign and the latter reign, the early church and the success of the gospel, and then the millennial glory that the church will experience, and all of the struggles in between. So these prophecies are all, in some sense, programmatic. These prophecies are all giving instruction for time to come, both the time of the establishing of the gospel. In fact, I pointed out some of these prophecies very clearly have to look beyond the building of the second temple. There's no way that they can terminate and have all their focus there. Just simply impossible. Now, that said, it's very true that they're still applicable, right? But as we look beyond the rebuilding of the temple, as we see it for what it is, typically, then there are certain features in these prophecies that take on a significance far beyond what we might assume if we were only to have that typical horizon, the typical event horizon. If that was it, if that was the whole prophecy referred to that, there are elements to some of these prophecies which simply go beyond what happens in the rebuilding of the second temple. You know, it's like you have a prophecy with a lot of leftover. And that leftover material is pointing down the road. It's pointing through that. It's telling us that there's more to come, if you will. That was not the full and total end that was in view, or was intended to be in view. So I want to begin going through Zechariah 5. We'll see verses 1 to 4 take up and comprise one very compact vision. And then the remainder, verses 5 through 11, pick up and develop a different theme. Now, there are a couple of images, particularly in that second part, that there is not really a consensus as to the meaning. I'm going to make a couple of suggestions probably along the way, and just note in passing why I suspect it might be. So let's begin with verse 1 of chapter 5 in Zechariah.
Zechariah 5:1. Then I turned and lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a flying roll.
I turned and lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a flying roll. All right, this is the beginning of the account of the sixth vision. So we are getting toward the end of all of these visions, and we're going to see here that unlike the other visions, the two in this chapter are different. The other visions, if you remember, were various ways of instilling confidence and bringing comfort and assurance regarding the promises of God, and drawing out the people to do their work, to put themselves forward zealously in the rebuilding of this second temple. And there are a lot of promises that were given in there. But these two prophecies or visions, which are really prophetical, these are warnings, particularly warnings of judgments. Now, they differ in a very significant respect, as we're going to see. The first is speaking in terms of individuals and maybe families. But the second one is taking up this warning with respect to the entire nation. So the change in subject matter, I think, is indicated here by the turning of the prophet. You know, he's looking in one direction, and there's promises of comfort and help from heaven and all of the different things that are going to fall into place. But he turns from these promises and assurances to see something else. Lifting up his eyes is expressing two things. First of all, lifting up his eyes is indicating that he is very aware of his dependence upon heaven. He is not approaching this from a position of self-sufficiency or as something that can be discerned in his own limited sphere. But lifting up of the eyes also is giving us an indication of the origin of what appears next. Now, this is not, again, something arising from the earth. This is something that he sees by lifting up his eyes. Lifting up of the eyes is one of those gestures in the Bible that is very often associated with praying. Lifting up the eyes to heaven. So what he's doing, we might even say that there's a prayerful element, and that, in a sense, comes out in this fact. As these visions progress, he is calling out to God, or calling out to the interpreting angel, to Christ, for help several times, trying to figure it out. He doesn't understand what he's seeing. Now, the looking that is referred to, or the seeing, is still that of the seer. He's a prophet, and he's beholding a heavenly vision. And as one commentator pointed out, there are some people who have thought that some of these visions are referring to the past, particularly because of the reference to Shinar or Babylon at the end of this chapter. But it doesn't really fit. All of these other visions have been forward-looking, and there's no reason to think that this is not forward-looking as well. Now, the word behold is telling us there's something that's worthy of our attention. It's something which has captured the attention of the prophet, and it's meant to capture our attention as well. And what it is this. He sees a scroll, which is really a parchment. It's some kind of large parchment that is flying like a bird. And as we'll see in a moment, it's not only large, but it's actually open. So it's a rollable parchment, but it's open. So it's like a big flying carpet. The flight of this scroll or roll points to the swiftness of its approach. It's moving quickly like a bird through the air. And that's exactly the imagery that's being evoked here. All right, verse 2.
Zechariah 5, verse 2. And he said unto me, what seest thou? And I answered, I see a flying roll, the length thereof is 20 cubits, and the breadth thereof 10 cubits.
Yeah, so, once more, we have the situation where the angel, the interpreting angel, who is Christ, asks Zechariah concerning this present vision. So the prophet turns, sees something. Now, the vision we understand to be a very serious vision, right? There's a sense of gravity in the fact that it's the voice of Christ again, calling his attention to this vision and its contents. Remember, he's the one who's involved in directing everything on behalf of the church, including all of the departments of providence. So what Zechariah sees is a flying scroll, which very clearly is here unrolled. We know that because he actually is able to discern dimensions. And of course, if you have a roll, a scroll that's rolled up, you can't tell how big that is. There's another indication that it's opened in one of the verses, one of the next verses, but it's very interesting. This, in comparison, for example, to that book in Revelation 5 that Christ alone can open. That's a book that needs to be opened. This is presented, if you will, as a book that's opened and both sides can be read. What is interesting about the parchment is the size of this parchment is exactly the dimension of the porch that is on the temple. We know that. If we can look at 1 Kings 6, verse 3, and 2 Chronicles 3, verse 4.
1 Kings 6, verse 3. And the porch before the temple of the house, 20 cubits was the length thereof, according to the breadth of the house, and 10 cubits was the breadth thereof before the house.
Second Chronicles 3, 4.
Second Chronicles 3, verse 4. And the porch that was in the front of the house, and the length of it was according to the breadth of the house, 20 cubits, and the height was 120. And he overlaid within with pure gold.
Okay, so this parchment is the exact dimension of the porch of the temple, which, by the way, the porch of the temple is where the law was going to be read to the people during sabbatical years, and that is once every 7 years, once the temple is completed. Now, we know this if we consider what we find in Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 and 11.
Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 and 11. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release and the feast of tabernacles, when all Israel has come to appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing.
Yeah, the place which thou shalt choose is the place where he chooses to put his name. And that is the temple. First the tabernacle, and then when the temple is built, it's the temple. So, this dimension tells us a couple of things, right? It shows that what is there is authoritative and it's somehow connected to the Jewish theocracy. But the connection signifies, it's unveiled or unrolled, it signifies that the law threatens curses upon the disobedient throughout the whole world. Okay, this is not a closed book like that book in Revelation 5. This is an open book because the Gentiles, which don't have this law, have the work of this law written in their hearts, as Paul says. So it does have a connection to all men. It's not restricted to the place of the altar where the intercession was made for the people of God. This proclamation of the law takes place upon the porch, which would put it in the hearing of all of the people, whether they were Jew or Gentile. Now, the fact that the size of this parchment exactly corresponds to the dimension of the porch is a declaration that is telling us that the execution of the curse, because we're going to see there's a curse in it, is going to be as large as the threatening of the law in its proclamation. Okay, so, in other words, not one law that's proclaimed in this porch in the providence of God will go unmet with condign punishment if it's broken. There's an exact correspondence. The providence of God, which is unveiled here, and is going to tell us something of the dilemma that is upon those people who've broken the law. That shares the size of that porch. So we need to understand there's a distinct correlation, correspondence between these things. You know, we can look at this in terms of the rebuilding of the temple. And remember, they're still rebuilding the temple. And that means that they should be getting an idea from this of some aspect of this temple that has universal applicability. Or it applies, as we'll see, it applies and it will apply to the nation of Israel in particular, because they're blessed with so much light. Verse 3.
Zechariah 5, verse 3. Then said he unto me, this is the curse that goeth forth over the face of the whole earth. For everyone that stealeth shall be cut off as on this side according to it. And everyone that sweareth shall be cut off as on that side according to it.
Yeah, again, we see from the language here in verse 3, this scroll or roll is unrolled. We can see what's on this side and on that side. Right? So the interpreting angel, again, is Christ. And he's now going to expound the typology of this flying roll. What he's saying is something like this. Flying roll is the curse of the Lord, which is going forth into and over all the land of Judea. Now, the fact that it's a roll with writing indicates that the contents are already determined. And just like the opening of the seals in the book in Revelation 5. There's already been a determination made. This is already determined. It's written down. These are not things that are going to be left open. They're not subject to escape or appeal. They're in trouble. This is determined. And it's a determination which very clearly there's this resemblance to the porch of the temple, but also because it's in writing. There's a determination now. The fact is this. For everyone who's not in Christ, the punishments of the law are curses. Right. Remember that word curse refers as well to the fact that there is a covenant behind this. This is a result of some kind of covenant. You know, they've taken on themselves an oath and a curse, and they're getting the curse part of it here. Now, the writing on both sides, in this case in particular, I think is showing that there is a marked connection to the two tables of the law. On the one side is denounced stealing, you know, which is clearly a sin against the second table of the law. But before we settle down on that, we do need to consider this idea of stealing is one that has very interesting and particular application to the building of the temple, this rebuilding of the temple. I want to look at Malachi 3:8.
Malachi 3, verse 8. Will a man rob God?
yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings?
The charge against the Jews at this point is that they've been robbing God. But Malachi is going to make that very explicit, but Haggai's already indicated that, you know, which we'll look at in just a moment. There's this notion that there's been a defrauding of God in the building of the temple, right? And so the stealing, there is stealing going on, but it's not limited to that second table of the law, although it is a sin against the second table of the law. On the other side of this, what is denounced is perjury, which is really a sin against the first table of the law. It's the taking of God's name in vain. Now, in Israel, and this was actually a practice common in the ancient Near East, when property was stolen or missing, a curse was pronounced against the person who took it. For example, look at Judges 17, verse 2.
Judges 17, verse 2. And he said unto his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursed, and spakest of also in mine ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, blessed be thou of the Lord, my son.
Yeah, there's a curse, and then he admits to taking it, and the situation changes. But if the accused did not confess, the curse of the Lord would fall upon him. And we see that, for example, held out in 1 Kings 8, verse 31. 1 Kings 8, verse 31.
1 Kings 8, verse 31. If any man trespass against his neighbor, and an oath be laid upon him, to cause him to swear, and the oath come before thine altar in this house.
Yeah, the fact is, if that happens, and you swear, and you can multiply situations like this throughout the Bible, there's a curse. In Numbers 5, the woman that was suspected of adultery is taken, and she's made to take a curse or an oath. And if she's guilty, the presumption is the Lord will avenge. So there is all of this bound up. This is a contest, and it's a contest in which somebody's not telling the truth. Somebody's robbing God. They may not think they're doing it, but he's going to avenge. Right, so we can say this in general, that every failure to keep the law is a breach that calls forth the curse of a broken covenant. There appears to be something very very much intimately connected with the building of the temple going on here. But there is really a kind of perjury every time you break the law. Okay, so robbing God of tithes and offerings to rebuild the temple, in this case, is really it's both perjury and covenant breaking. You know, they're stealing and their perjury or their covenant breaking all kind of go together here. You can't really separate the one from the other, and that makes sense if we consider this. James says if you offend in one thing with regard to the law, you've broken it all. You can't just say, oh, I only broke that part of the law. No, you've offended against the infinite majesty. But in this case, with respect to the rebuilding of the temple, very specifically, these two things are tied together. They were brought back. They were, in fact, if you remember in Ezra and Nehemiah, one of the things they do is they renew covenant. So there is a covenant-breaking aspect and perjury involved when they're not allowing the money to go forward in the building of this temple. They're required to build or to utilize their funds. They're supposed to be putting aside the money necessary for the rebuilding of this temple. And they're not. Remember Haggai said they're doing other things. All right, so then that brings us to verse 4, which pulls all of this together.
Zechariah 5, verse 4. I will bring it forth, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter into the house of the thief, and into the house of him that sweareth falsely by my name, and it shall remain in the midst of his house, and shall consume it with the timber thereof and the stones thereof.
So again, the angel, and notice now the angel speaking as the Lord of hosts, in order to make it very clear. Christ is making it very clear that God is the one who's the executioner of his own threatenings. This is not something that's being left to men to bring to pass. And God is not out of the punishment loop here. He's the one executing it. Right? He's going to make them effectual. You know, what kind of punishment would it be if it wasn't actually punishment, right? If it wasn't actually causing the kind of hurt that it was meant to inflict. All right, this curse here is in some respects reminiscent of Haggai 1 verse 4.
Haggai 1, verse 4. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your soiled houses, in this house of the least?
So, there's a threatening as a result of this, and this is, you know, the emphasis at the end of the verse on the timber and the stones. Remember, Haggai's saying, look, you should have been building the house of God. Instead, you've been consumed with building your own houses. You've put aside your first duty, seeking first the kingdom of God and all these things being added. You've gone out of your way to seek something else first. And so he's threatening now to cut off not only the sinner. That's severe enough. The sinner is the one who's been neglecting the building of the house of God so he could build his own house, right? But what is going to happen is God is going to cut off not just that person, but he's threatening to cut off the whole house and family of the one who's doing that. So although it's in this prophecy or vision, it's more individualistic oriented. The fact is this, it doesn't stop there. It contemplates a covenant relation between the sinner and his family. Now, there's another interesting little part of this, I think, and that is the curse is now flying throughout the whole land. Right? Again, we're talking about Judea. And we're told that there's a promise here that it's going to enter the house of every thief and the house of whoever swore falsely in the Lord's name, claiming to be innocent when he was guilty. Okay, so it's going to enter in. The curse is, in a sense, almost personified here as pursuing the sinner. The curse causeless does not come. And here it is. It's got a cause. You claim you're innocent, but you're guilty. You know, you were supposed to be helping build that temple. What were you doing? We were building our own stuff. And so the curse is going to remain in the house of the sinner until it's utterly consumed. In other words, all of the ill-gotten gains, all that you've achieved in this way, he's saying it's going to be taken away. The curse is going to remain there until all of that is gone. It's just, this is the way it's going to be. So that's a threatening against sinners, individual sinners. And it's a threatening that reaches from them to their house and their family. But that's not all. Because in verse 5, we begin with another vision. And in this vision, the threatened judgments are going to go farther. So let's look at verse 5.
Zechariah 5, verse 5. Then the angel that talked with me went forth and said unto me, Lift up now thine eyes and see what is this that goeth forth.
Yeah, so this is the beginning of the seventh vision. And it's actually quite interesting. The angel here, Christ, again, the angel that's going forth to execute the curses, right? He's going forth to do that. He's, remember, God is going to execute his own curses. Here he is going forth to do that. But in going forth, he wants to call Zechariah's attention to one more thing. Now, this change is indicative of a change in vision. There's another vision beginning, and it's another warning. Once more, Christ is pressing the prophet to take a look at the vision. He's got to turn his attention from the flying roll. He's still possibly thinking about that. And now he has to look at another judgment going forth much like the roll. Okay, the scope of the sixth vision, as I said, was concerned with how the Lord is going to pursue the sins of particular persons and subject them to private destruction or punishment. On the other hand, this vision is actually declaring that God is going to punish the whole nation and cast them out of their land when the measure of their iniquity, their national sins, had reached the full measure. It had finally come to fruition, if you will. Right, so, the people... the people who are individual sinners are also having a deleterious effect on the nation. Look at verse 6.
Zechariah, verse 6. And I said, What is it? And he said, This is an ephah that goeth forth. He said, Moreover, this is their resemblance through all the earth.
Okay, so again, what do we see? You see here, once more, the prophet is clearly dependent upon Christ. He can't understand this vision apart from that. Now, I think this points up some interesting philosophical point, and that is it's something we really see in visions and typology and prophecy all. They really demonstrate that the meaning and the interpretation is dependent upon the light that rationality sheds upon them, illuminating them, right? Christ, in other words, is the light that lighteth every man who cometh into the world. And in his light, we see light. And apart from that, this all means nothing. We can't make sense of anything, right? The fact is, there are no root facts. That is, there are no bare facts. There are no objective truths outside of him who upholds all things by the power of his breath, that is the Spirit of God. In other words, there is no independent reality that is independent of God. Right? There's nothing that has meaning apart from God. All is dependent upon him. And here we see clearly, Zechariah, who is a prophet of God, is unable to discern the object, even the object in this case, of the vision, until Christ gives him the perception needed to see it for what it is. He just doesn't get it until then. I know this is a philosophical tangent I'm on right now. But it is an important question of epistemology, how we know, and what is available to us to know.
Isn't that proved by Solomon when he asks for wisdom?
Wisdom, we could miss that on wisdom. This is really something more than that. Zechariah can't even understand what the empiricists would call sensory data. Right? He can't even discern that for what it is. It's not a matter of having a light outside of him turned on. He needs a light inside of him turned on so that he can see it for what it is. Now, what does he see? Well, this is one of these visions in the Bible that is relatively generic. Most of the parts are relatively clear. There are a couple points, as I said earlier, that are not so clear. We're going to have to talk about them as well. But first of all, now that Christ has pointed this out, he sees there an ephah. If you know what an ephah is, an ephah is a unit of measure that was used among the Hebrew people, and not just them, but again, people in the ancient Near East, this was a measure, a dry measure unit that they used. If you want to use if you want to measure dry goods, use an ephah. The Egyptians had one, the Hebrews had one, the Babylonians had one. It was a unit of measure. They were not exactly the same, but usually pretty close. An ephah really is equal to a bath. If we look at Ezekiel 45:11.
Ezekiel 45:11. The ephah and the bath shall be of one measure, that the bath may contain a tenth part of an homer, and the ephah the tenth part of an homer, and the measure thereof shall be after the homer.
So, the ephah, if you could imagine, is the dry measure, the bath is the wet measure. They theoretically are measuring the same amount, same volume. The what this, I think, is saying, and it appears to be borne out in the entire context, is something along these lines. This is God pointing out that his judgments are measured. God's judgments are not off the cuff. They're not too hot. They're not too cold. They're just right. This ephah represents the land of Judea over which the eye of the Lord watches with a particular providence. Now, I say that because in the Hebrew, this is their resemblance through all the earth. Is really, this is their eyes in all the earth. There is an eye. The resemblance from a divine perspective. That is, they're being assessed from a divine perspective. So it represents the divine accounting that's going on as the measure is being filled with the sins of the land. Nothing they're doing is going to be missed, right? God is watching them, and if they go beyond, they're going to face a greater filling of this cup of wrath. This is essentially what is called the cup of wrath. It's being filled. Now, interestingly enough, we look at verse 7.
Verse 7, and behold, there was lifted up a talent of lead, and this is a woman that sitteth in the midst of the ephah.
Yeah, the prophet can hardly pause, and his attention is actually drawn now to something else. Once he starts to understand, once he has that proper perspectival grid to be able to perceive the vision, he doesn't just see the ephah, he sees more. First, he notices a talent of lead. A talent is a large piece of something. Talent of lead would have been about 130 pounds in our measurement. And it was much, much larger. And this is really the point. It is nearly four times larger, heavier, more volume, more weight, however you want to look at it, whether we look at it in terms of volume or weight. It's almost four times that of the ephah. And it's being positioned vis-a-vis the ephah, as we will see. This talent of lead symbolizes the heavy judgments of God, which are hanging over the head of the nation, which in due time would allow to fall upon them. Again, this is made very clear in the coming verses. Now, the woman in the midst of the ephah is the Jewish people. Particularly, I think we have to view this woman as the Jewish people taken under the taken as a church, as feminine in particular. And this woman sitting in the ephah represents the Jews under this impending national judgment. So they're there in this ephah, in the midst of the ephah, right in the middle of it. What's happening in the ephah? It's being filled with this measure of the wrath of God. Right, verse 8.
Zechariah 5, verse 8. And he said, this is wickedness, and he cast it into the midst of the ephah, and he cast the weight of the lead upon the mouth thereof.
Right, so, again, the first thing we can say right off the top, this is wickedness, right? This is judgment for their sins. You can't miss that point here. This woman is their wickedness growing up in iniquity. It's their the church of the Jews apostatizing and filling up the measure. The perseverance in sin against various lesser calamities and judgments which they've already had, it points to a capstone sin. It's going to lead to the talent of lead being cast over the mouth of the ephah like a millstone. We're really looking for something that fills up the cup of their wrath, of God's wrath against the Jews. All right, and there is something that fits that very description. It points, I think, unmistakably here now to the condemnation of the Jews after they fill up the measure of their iniquities by crucifying Christ and rejecting the gospel. This is it. This is the point at which the Jewish church is finally cut off. It's buried under its iniquity. This slab of lead comes down on top of the ephah and, you know, crushes that woman in the ephah. The judgment, and this is, I think, something you have to understand is relatively clear here. The judgment foretold here connotes a far greater punishment than the late Babylonian captivity. Remember, that only lasted 70 years. They're just getting back from that. That was real. Okay, but it was not a judgment of this magnitude. Right, this is looking for some sort of a heavy judgment that's going to not only is going to fall over the mouth of the ephah. You know, and the woman's inside. Imagine if that talent of lead falls over this, it's overshadowing it. So it's sealing them up in darkness. And there's a promise here that they're going to suffer far longer than they had previously. Now, this is, I think, at least in part, keeping with what Paul has said. The blindness has come upon Israel because of the rejection of the gospel. And they're going to be left under that power of their sin, until vengeance has been executed to the full. So this is, remember, it's national judgments. Although this is talking about Israel specifically, you know, we can apply this principle. Every nation presumably would have a tipping point like this. You hit that point, there's no going back. All right, verse 9.
Zechariah 5, verse 9. Then lifted I up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came out two women, and the wind was in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork. And I lifted up the ephah between the earth and the heaven.
Okay, so one more time. He's lifting up his eyes. Again, that idea of dependence. There's this prayerful attitude that is being conveyed there. And he's also, again, looking to heaven with respect to what he's seeing. And behold, right? There's something which, one more time, catches his attention. Can't miss it. And what's interesting is this language. There came out two women. Right? It's just like the ephah came out. It sort of materialized. The wind in their wings indicates, I think, a likeness to the angels as messengers sent from God. So they're like angels, in one sense at least. Now the two together are engaged in removal of the ephah. Now when the cup is full, when the measure is complete, the Jews are going to be removed from their land. Now, I think one thing that most people have really failed to comment on, other than to note you need two women to carry ephah to its appointed place because it's so full, there have been some suggestions these two women appoint to two nations. And that certainly may be true. I think there are a couple of possibilities here. If we understand these women as being related to, in some sense, religion, then what we may well have are two women, one of whom might actually be the woman inside the ephah, in a sense, because although their outworking is like messengers, and they're doing this bidding of God, they're carrying out judgment on themselves, because that's really what's happening here. It may well be that we've got the Jews and the Romans each contributing to this, but if we want to consider it under a much more strict religious sense, then perhaps we're talking about the Jews and the early Christians. That as a result of both, they're in this position, right, where they're being carried off to an appointed place. Now, they face captivity and exile amongst the profane nations. That's what we see is going on here. Remember, we're talking about the Jews. They're scattered from enjoying the face of God and fellowship in his ordinances. And, in fact, you know, they appear to be scattered to the four winds. Now, there's also some disagreement, and this is really one of the more puzzling verses in Zechariah so far. There's been some speculation about the stork. Some who just say it has long pinions so that it can get underneath the handles and carry the ephah. There are some who point out that the stork is an unclean bird. On the other hand, it is carrying off and doing God's work. I think there maybe is another possibility here, and that's this. Not only is the stork under one consideration considered unclean, there's something very interesting about the stork in comparison to another bird mentioned in the Bible, the ostrich. The stork is noted for its care that it takes with regard to its young. That's why you have pictures of storks delivering babies, you know, the whole idea of a stork delivering a baby is because storks were and are notable as being very careful for their young. So what they're doing here is they're lifting up the Jewish nation under judgment to a place between heaven and earth. Right? They're carried to what is essentially a middling position, And that middling position is a position which means that on the one hand, perhaps they're cut off from the gospel, or the gospel church, which is heaven, but they're not quite the same as those who dwell upon the earth. You know, they're somewhere in between. You know, the Jews have had a very interesting destiny since the destruction of Jerusalem. Right? They're kept in a judgment, but somehow, unlike others, they've remained distinct from those around them. In fact, I cannot think of any other people in any similar situation who've been able to maintain a completely separate identity from the cultures in which they find themselves over such a long period of time. There is somewhere between heaven and earth. Look at verse 10.
Then said I to the angel that talked with me, whither do these bear thee up?
Yeah, so Zechariah sees them carrying it off, and now he inquires after their fate. He sees them lifted up under judgment, but he can't see the end of the matter. He's not really seeing this. But this is pointing to the days of vengeance when the Romans came and took away the nation of the Jews. And they crushed them. They scattered them. Because of the Jews, or because of the Romans, I should say, the Jews had to wander in various countries, often countries of their enemies. Now, with that hanging before him, Zechariah turns again to Christ because he wants more information. Remember, he's the angel who's talking with him. And of course, he alone is going to know the outcome of this judgment. What's going to be the outcome of the destruction of the Jewish nation? Where will the Old Testament people of God be carried? That's what he's asking. And it's a good question. You know, last time, where were they carried? To Babylon. This time it's going to be worse. Here's verse 11.
Verse 11, and he said unto me to build it an house in the land of Shinar, and it shall be established and set there upon her own base.
So Christ is telling the prophet that the Jews are going to build a house in the land of Shinar. I want to look at Genesis 11, 2 and 3.
Genesis 11. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar.
So the land of Shinar is Babylon. It's Babel. What we're told here is something I think like this. We're being told that when they're taken away, they're going to dwell alone as a house, particularly in a land signified by Babylon. Is this mystic Babylon? I think in terms of our type and antitype, we might find some profitability, especially if we look at what's happened with the Jews in European nations and how they've insinuated themselves. All right? There is reason, perhaps, to think that. They're in Shinar, in Babylon. We're told that they're going to be established, which is to say, they're really remaining obstinate opposers of the gospel. They're not being converted. Right? They're not being brought back. They're resting in their own works and their own righteousness. And it's precisely because of this, in fact, that I suspect that this is pointing to their participation in bolstering and propping up mystic Babylon, because they have common cause with Mystery Babylon in opposing Christ.
So you would say that they helped the Roman Catholic Church?
They're in league with all of these. In some respects, they found it congenial to work together with those who were in opposition to the gospel. Right. Remember, they still rejected Christ. They're still under this judgment. And this is exactly what Paul tells us. They're going to remain in this blindness under this national judgment until that blindness is removed, which is what Paul is predicting in Romans 11. Right? When he talks about the blindness being removed and then them being grafted in again. And so this seems to be pointing to that national judgment which is coming as a result of all of their neglect. And we actually see the reason, right? Typically, the reason is in the rebuilding of the temple, they were careless. They were concerned about other things first. And so when Christ comes, they're behaving the same way. And this is not going to change until the millennium, going into the millennium. Okay, and actually, I do think Zechariah has something to say about the restoration and conversion of the Jews later in his book. We will come to that. But next time, we'll look at the vision in chapter 6, and that the vision in chapter 6 is really going to take us to the end of the visionary portion of Zechariah's book.